I spread a song so you can sing along with my special guest or two.
Or two.
You like to sing and dance, and this podcast by chance explores musicals for you. Theme song, yeah.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Life's But a Song, a podcast that likes to live in the land of musicals. I'm your host, John, and with me today are two-thirds of the hosts of the Love of Cinema podcast. It's Jeff Ostermuller and John Say.
Woo!
Hey-o.
Dave is not here today, and I'm a little upset about that because I wanted to hear what he thought on American history via this movie. How are you both doing today?
Good. We're great.
Jeff? Yeah, how are you doing?
Good. I got a new cat. Was John asking me or the?
I'm asking both. I'm asking everyone how you all do.
We're
which John are you talking about?
Together, yeah. We're gonna have to be more specific.
John,
there,
no H.
John, no H.
No H.
No,
I'm
just asking everyone how we're doing, just to set it off before we get into our discussion, which is the 2000. I don't know if this is a cult classic. I know it's like well beloved, but Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? It was written and directed by Joel Cohen and Ethan Cohen, and according to IMDb, in the Deep South during the 1930s, three escaped convicts search for hidden treasure while relentless lawmen pursues them. I mean, that is very vague.
That's the whole movie.
Yeah.
Who needs to see it now?
Yeah, let's like totally gloss over the fact that it's based off of the Odyssey and everything.
Kind of weird they don't put that in the IMDb blurb, but yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you guys... Okay, I've never read the Odyssey. Have either of you?
Is that the one with Agamemnon and shit?
No.
Or is that the Iliad? I tried reading one or two of them, and I was like, what the fuck is happening? I thought Odyssey was like an adventure. And they're just like talking about a bunch of gods and shit, and like they're just angry. But it didn't make any sense.
I mean, the Odyssey is not. God, we sound like idiots, you guys. But isn't that with Odysseus?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So
I mean,
then
we've seen so many adaptations of it, though. And no one you know except for your friend who was a fucking English classics major and has ever bullshitted and said they've even actually read it. Didn't read all of it.
My real estate broker was an English classics major from London. That's true.
So text them and see if they read it.
Respond. I would not recommend the Iliad then.
The Coens apparently claimed that they've never read it either.
Sure.
They just base this off of what they've seen. And I'm not gonna lie, I'm kind of intrigued to read it because I obviously they condense it down a lot.
You think we could read it an hour and 26 minutes?
Well, okay. So you watched it on Hulu, I'm assuming?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where it's an hour and 26. I rented it on Prime and there's an extra 20 minutes. I don't know what was cut for the...
Did they build in the ads?
No.
Wait. Wasn't it an hour 26? I'm just looking at the IMDb and it says an hour 47.
Yeah,
for
that's
the
one time. That's the one I watched. I don't know.
I felt like mine was tight.
I mean,
it's just
a tight
well-cut,
anyway.
Well-paced movie. Where did an hour 26 come from? Why did you even pull that number out?
It's on Hulu at an hour and 26 minutes. So I don't know.
It is, right?
Cut. Yeah.
Wait, am I so crazy now? We have a legitimate film podcast.
I didn't even know there were two cuts of this.
Apparently. Yes, I was right. John with an H, you dick. John, no H. Yes, Hulu says.
An hour and 26.
Hour and 26.
Yes, but I watched it on Prime and it was an hour and 40 something.
Let's go scene by scene and we'll figure it out.
Good God.
Okay. Well, I mean, honestly, to set the story of the Odyssey in Depression era South and making it a musical was kind of like an undertaking. And I believe this is what introduced George Clooney to the Coen brothers, because they then did multiple films afterwards together.
Yeah.
He said on his Inside the Actors Studio that he didn't really know them, but they sent him a script and he told his agent yes before he read the script.
Yeah, that's what I've been reading too. And I don't know how truthful
they said
is.
He will be the lead of this movie. And Roger Deakins is filming it. Who, by the way, Roger Deakins is like Dave's favorite cinematographer because he's from Australia. So Dave really probably wishes he could be here. But instead, he's at the theater.
How dare he? Now, I'm the one who picked this one for both of you for your podcast, because I know on your podcast, you try not to ding things, or you have a whole like drink when you say something negative about it. And yeah. I'm not going to lie, before I hit play on this movie, there was a slight inkling where I was like, I know I remember liking this movie, but I haven't seen it in a while. So, but I mean, I still enjoyed it thoroughly. I don't know what did you guys feel about it?
John, Jeff, with an H.
When was the last time you guys rewatched? Was this your first rewatch since seeing it for the very first time? Is this like the second time you've seen this movie?
I thought you and I saw it together when we were at the apartment. I thought we watched it together.
Yeah, I think
we did.
That
was probably the last time I watched it all the way through.
And I think we watched it because our old roommate, shout out to Al Hoverman, is really, really into that that folk kind of style of music. And he, kind of like the Coen brothers, has this fascination with that like kind of like folk white culture, like that. Yeah. I mean, the fact that these brothers grew up where they grew up, Michigan or something, like somewhere in the Midwest, the Coen brothers, and they seem to have this unusual fascination with folk music. And folk music is, you know, traditionally associated with Anglo-Saxon white immigrants who came here and lived in the hills and the South and just kind of was birthed from there. And I am from North Carolina. So like I fucking heard some of this music growing up. I mean, still being sung by choirs and just you hear it at community gatherings and stuff. You know, I mean, there are some of these songs that like literally this was not the only time I'd ever heard them before.
Yeah. How many times did you sing on the sunny side of life?
My wife literally told me, this is a true fucking statement. I'm going to put this out here. She remembers a day camp when she was a child where you were transferred on a school bus, like from like Boys and Girls Club to like the day camp. And on the school bus ride, they would teach you and these little children to sing along with Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Get out of here.
That is some Southern white shit right there, isn't it?
That is Southern white shit.
And probably not even limited to white people, but that is some Southern shit. And that really fucking happened. I mean, yes. So songs like that, like we heard them growing up.
Wow.
I've
only heard, well, besides You Are My Sunshine, I've only heard these songs from this movie. And
Kanye West did a version of I'll Fly Away before he, I don't want to finish my sentence.
And you heard,
no, you,
I think
you just did
heard,
finish your sentence.
Don't you guys remember I think it was on the Dixie Chicks album Fly, and on one of that songs they do a tiny little I'll fly away, and they just have like a tiny little moment in their song, and it's a nod to I'll Fly Away. So I mean, it's, people have heard these songs, have just been, man, they've been around.
And it looks like the Coen brothers or whoever helped them with
T-Bone
this catalog.
T-Bone Burnett. Yeah.
Yeah. They at least kept to the time period. It's not like a Baz Luhrmann where it's anachronistic or anything like that. Right. So they kept to 1930s and earlier. Well, except for the Poe Lazarus, which I'm seeing is recorded in 1959. But I mean, that's a Chain Gang song, it sounds like.
And I was going to say, that sounds like a spiritual that could have been, who knows when it actually came into existence, right?
Yeah, because I mean, I'm looking at the IMDb page for the soundtrack, and it just says for the writers, Poe Lazarus was written by Traditional.
Traditional.
Yeah,
I'm ready. Can I tell a quick story? Can I pop in since we're talking about the soundtrack?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So my friend was a manny. He was a male nanny. And he wanted to do this. And there's a family that had three boys, so they wanted a manny. And he signed me up as the backup manny. I didn't think I would actually have to step up, but I did. So I had to be a manny for this family for 2 weeks. This is true. Crap, shit. Can you bleep that out?
Sure, no, you don't bleep it out.
There's a lot of people.
Everybody's named Chris. Nobody, you don't have to bleep that out.
He was meeting with the assistant in the penthouse of this apartment. And he goes in their office for the interview. I said, I don't know who this family is, but what did they win a Grammy for? she says, "You recognize that?" And he goes, "Yeah, yes, I know what a Grammy is. What is it for?" She said, "Well, he won a Grammy for Oh Brother Where Art Thou. He's in the movie. He's in the movie Oh Brother Where Art Thou, and that's his Grammy." And Chris was like, "Well, it's not John Turturro, and it's not George Clooney, is it? Tim Blake Nelson?" And it was. I mannied. I'm ready to tell this because it's been more than 10 years. I mannied for Tim Blake Nelson's family for 2 weeks. More than 10 years ago. That is 100% true. I've seen the Oh Brother Where Art Thou Grammy. That's true. And it was while he was getting ready to film Lincoln, if you want to put your time period together. That is my story. And now I live a block from that apartment. I live a block, and I've been trying to see when I go to my rooftop here. I want to see them. I want to see them walking around to see if they still live there.
I wish the Grammy was given to the Soggy Bottom Boys. Was it given to, like, the Oh Brother Where Art Thou cast or something, or did you happen to read?
It just said like best album from a motion picture or album, show or whatever. So, and then it had as his name.
So Tim Blake Nelson is actually the only one out of the three who does sing in the movie. The rest of them,
John Turturro, that yodel was definitely not him.
That's not him. And George Clooney is not singing "I Am a Man of Constant Sorrow." Tried to, I mean, from what I read, he took lessons and tried to get it, but he was inevitably dubbed. Speaking of the soundtrack, according to the IMDb trivia, it says the film soundtrack became an unlikely blockbuster, even surpassing the success of the film. By early 2001, it had sold 5 million copies, spawned a documentary film, 3 follow-up albums, Oh Sister and Oh Sister 2, 2 concerts, and 1 Country Music Awards for Album of the Year and Single of the Year for Man of Constant Sorrow. It also won 5 Grammys, including Album of the Year and hit number 1 Billboard album charts the week of March 15th, 2002, 63 weeks after the release and over a year after the release of the film.
Jesus.
Like, this movie, I mean, it's all about the music, really.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, like, other Coen Brothers films, yes, music is an important element to it. Like, I'm thinking of Hail Caesar, where they do have actual musical moments going on, but nothing compares to this movie.
And I think it's really important to differentiate between this and a musical, where the music in this story doesn't exclusively move a character's narrative forward. There are moments where people they encounter are singing, like the sirens, you know, which is like, of course, like that is a musical sequence, I would say. But for the most part, the music is just a part of the world, the diegetic world that this story takes part in.
Right.
You know, there are live performances, but they're at a political rally or something like that.
Right. And they're even spotted at the live performance, but the song itself didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah. They even sing their hit song as a means to an end. It doesn't actually move their character or their story forward necessarily.
Yeah. They're not explaining while they're singing the song. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is even just the needle thread right there of what you just said is insane. We have seen plenty of soundtracks to movies that are really excellent, you know, performing super well on the, what is that great line that Adam Scott says in Parks and Rec when April gets in the car with him and she's like, "Why do you have so many movie soundtracks?" And he's like, "It's like the director picked a playlist." You know, I think people have been listening to soundtracks for a long time, but this one is so unique because one, it's not necessarily original music, but it's music that is not already popular music. It wasn't pop music that was put into a playlist by a director or whatever. And some of it is original. It is, you know, totally for a not musical movie with music. I don't know. It's just such a unique experience. So unusual, right?
I know we talk about different variations of musical on this, where like sometimes it's just about the music industry. Sometimes they're music videos loosely strung together. But this one, like, it's such an important element to it because I don't know if it helps ground the time period that we're in or if it's just like, you know, music was used for different things and showing the different, like how, what's the song that they use? Actually, You Are My Sunshine. You Are My Sunshine is used for that one political
Yeah, where they're sweeping, just constantly sweeping things.
Yeah, or like, you know, you get that weird moment at the Klan rally where there's they sing
Odeth.
Where I'm honestly, as moments like that in movies where I'm just like, how do you feel about this actors? Like, we knew, what was the discussion said that you're going to now be a Klans person and do rhythmic choreography?
Oh, the extras, especially, right? Yeah.
I mean, as long as they come out looking like the fools, then I'm sure everybody, hopefully enough people would be interested in being like, yeah, I'll do that. That sequence specifically, I had forgotten that was the challenging gubernatorial candidate.
I did too.
I was like, no, I know it's somebody. I couldn't quite remember. And then when he tears his hood, I was just like, oh,
then
he has the
small person next to him. And it was like, and once he took his mask off, he was like, oh, duh, like a fucking course. I forgot too. But it's funny. I remember the line, like, I'm a member of a certain secret organization, secret society. I think we
don't
all
think
know
it needs
what
to be.
I forgot about it. And I was like, oh my God, I totally, yeah, but, it's all there. I just forgot it.
Look at this. We are very naturally approaching on why the movie is the crux of this, music is the crux of this movie. The turn of the screw at the very end, the climax of this picture, what actually gets them out of their first false resolution before they get to nearly being hung in the miracle of the river, you know, the damming of the valley coming. The first one is when you think they're going to be outed for being criminals in their own stage, singing Oconsoro. This gubernatorial candidate basically outs them and says, no, they were just trying to destroy something that we all say we value, which is organized racism, you know, the Ku Klux Klan. And they basically, the town turns against him because they love their music. And that's it. That is the only reason why they are on their side. Because he's trying to tell
crimes.
Them to stop singing.
Yeah.
Exactly. It has nothing to do with who they are as people or the
they become
the
a lynch mob.
The situation. Yeah.
Right. The,
yeah.
The crowd also, surprisingly, doesn't say anything about Tommy, who is a black man.
Yes.
He is like the only like black man with a name in this movie. And a real person. Like, that's the fascinating thing about this movie is that you've got all of these historical figures thrown into this story and it works.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was gonna say, the robber, Babyface.
George Nelson.
Yeah, George Nelson. Yeah.
Apparently he died before this movie is supposed to take place, but like, who cares?
Yeah.
It's not like it's a decade earlier than when he died. It's like just like a year, like 3 years maybe.
So funny. Well, look at George. Guess he's back on top again.
Tim Blake Nelson's fucking funny in this movie. The way he runs is so hilarious.
So much of it.
The way that he's convinced that Pete is turned into a frog, just like,
and then later
he was a toad.
He was
Pete was turned into a toad. Now he wasn't turned into a toad.
God, it's so good. Yes, the only named black character in there again. We all know from very early on, sold of the devil for music. I still think that is part of the theme, that by the very end, the question and answer that is posed to people is racism, very pointed racism, like it's in the narrative in that scene. Is that going to get in the way of them judging these people? And it does not. They care about the music more. So I think that in a very real way, I think they're making a point there that like, we kind of don't, there might be more of a spiritual connection between the music than anything that religion has ever offered.
That's the thing about Tommy Johnson, who is the real person, was a blues player, and people thought he sold his soul to the devil. So like, they are incorporating things, as well as Babyface was a little bit of a trigger finger and a hothead, and they incorporated that. I'm sure there were political figures back in the day who may have been a grand wizard or whatever the fuck they're called for the Klan.
Oh, we've had presidents that were in the credits.
I don't know what you're talking about, John.
Oh, for sure.
I know this is coming out after the election, but like, my God, I felt like, crazy. Oh shit, this is life imitating art imitating life right now.
I know. They don't know we're making fun of them, but we are.
It's interesting that Papi O'Daniel in real life is the governor of Texas, not Mississippi. But I love the idea of the Coen brothers being so smart, and they're like a nerd's dream come true. And I mean that with all the love and respect. They look like folk singers. And then two of their most famous movies, Fargo, they say it's based on a real story when it's not. They just wanted to mess with the audience. And this, it's based on the Odyssey. And they're like, I don't really know what the Odyssey's about. We just thought that would. But they didn't want to advertise it ahead of time, which is probably not their decision. But they wanted to put it at the beginning of the movie to make it seem like it was really like classful and thoughtful. But ultimately, they're like, yeah, we just thought it might be cool, you know, to draw on some things from fucking. Yeah. Like
the answer, every director, if you really push them hard enough, why did you do this? That's the only answer is really, I just thought it would be cool.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, like,
I was trying to make a good movie. Yeah, I was trying to make a good movie.
All right. And because I watched this on Prime, there was that X-ray feature where you can like read the trivia, see the cast and everything. Oh, yeah. And they would mention connections to other films every 5 seconds, it felt like. And I was just like, are we sure that every scene in this is connecting to something else? Like, couldn't it just been like the Coen brothers were like, well, they got to get out of the nooses somehow, so let's bring the flood in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. There's probably a flood in the Odyssey, fuck if I know, but, you know.
There's a whole, like...
There's a flood.
I feel like it goes by, like, they travel by sea in that, from what I remember hearing.
Yeah. Yeah, so, it's Odysseus. They get lost in the ocean. They get lost on a journey, and they...
When they were trying to make electrical farms.
Right, but there's also the Cyclops, which is John Goodman's character.
Yeah, right. The Sirens.
Who dies by the Sirens.
Yes,
there is the mystical... So the main thing that I think we should definitely point out is that the Odyssey is one of the first references Joseph Campbell uses, along with Epic of Gilgamesh, of the hero's journey was something that arrived organically out of the most successful storytelling that was oral for centuries. And when these things were finally written down, there are certain, you know, touchstones that you can see. One of them is that a mystical character will enter your world and change your entire like existence and like send you down a path. And this is our, in this movie, it's our blind, what do you call that thing on the railroad?
What's the name of that pump where you pump up?
Yeah.
A cart? Pump cart for railroad tracks. Yeah.
I mean, so as soon as he comes in and he basically says, you will be on a long journey. You will see a cow on a roof. You will blah, blah, blah. You know, you kind of know from that point that there is a literary stance on you being told these people are about to go on a journey. And there's also just something mental, I think, about being put in that situation. It almost gives you the leeway you're talking about, Jeff, of like, well, they're doing this thing that has taken place in like classic literature, so we're going to assume that geniuses made this. And I think the Coen brothers are fucking intelligent, but I bet they were like, I don't know, we just thought that was cool. Like, you know, we're just, yeah, sure. Like they run into these things and we're going to take them down some, so there are going to be certain parallels, but I don't think they held themselves so accountable that every single beat in the Odyssey is hit cleanly.
Oh God,
here.
No. Oh yeah. No. That book is massive, but like they managed to like distill it down into the different like beats of them meeting somebody new. And then obviously it all coming back at the end. And then they're also just like, oh, hey, our good friend John Goodman needs a part.
Also, Ulysses is the Roman name for Odysseus.
Yes. Yeah. And then Homer, which is the name of the political, the governor, the person running for governor, is the name of the author. Is the author. Of
there you go.
The Odyssey.
So there you go.
There's paying homage, but not like blatantly. Like, yes, they call the three women sirens and all that, but they also call them whores and prostitutes, so like it makes sense like in a way with all of the southern ness added into this film.
Yeah,
the southern.
We're in a tight spot.
Sorry, I'm a Yankee, so I don't really a lot of references that they're making. I don't really know, because I'm a northerner, if you will.
Sure.
Just like the way they talk.
Yeah, well, okay, so George Clooney doesn't really have a southern accent, yes?
Or am I was going to ask you guys if that frustrated you at all.
He's doing his fast talking, semi southern accent that he's done in other films. I can't.
Which he's from the Midwest, right? So it probably wouldn't be too hard for him to muster up in the southern, right?
I guess so. I have often wondered
Kansas,
because I've never really heard George Clooney. And this, you know, being able to do accents and dialects doesn't make you a good actor. You know, I'd rather somebody be in the moment, which he is. He's got a good sense of humor. He's right for the part. He hits all the right beats. But I've never heard him do an accent before. So I think it's probably more likely that he just couldn't do it.
He's from Kentucky. I said Kansas. He's from Kentucky. Come on.
I know, but not really. Remember, they moved over here pretty soon when his aunt got, like, you've heard his life story. Like, you know much about him?
Did he get drafted into majors? Didn't he play for the Reds?
I don't remember, but he didn't live there for most of his life. He lived here for most of his.
You're saying it's his talent. He did win a Golden Globe for actor in a musical or comedy.
For this movie?
Yeah.
I just said it's not necessarily talent of your acting ability to be able to do a dialect. I'm sure there are plenty of technicians out there.
Remember we did West Side Story in college and I was the lighting operator because I couldn't dance? And you could tumble because you did gymnastics, so they made you just do all these fucking tumbling moves all the time. Chino. John was Chino.
That was.
Do you remember that? And then we had our. Oh. It was awesome. We had our Tony.
Sorry, the fact that John was
hilarious.
Yeah,
he killed your bro.
Yeah, most Chinos look like John for about 6 years.
Right? You're in high school or college in America. Yep, unfortunately, that is definitely true.
And our Tony didn't have an accent because they thought that it would be good if like the lead was more of an everyman, even though that makes no sense because he's supposed to be in the gang. But that's how it worked. So maybe. They excused his lack of accent talent.
I mean,
so that everybody else had wild accents and he had.
I think this watch of it, I think I gave him my own backstory that like he is from the North, but he's like a Harold Hill in the way where he doesn't have a home. And then he just settled in Mississippi with
had
Holly
eight
Hunter
children. Yeah.
And just having litters of kids.
I love that detail. I think that's so cute. And I can't remember if Odysseus has fucking, I know he has children, but I can't remember if there are a bunch of girls specifically, but that detail is so funny. When he realizes those are his daughters, like no way you fucking saw that coming the first time you watch this movie.
Right.
He's no, because like, did they say blah 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 when he says their last name and that's what upsets him and you don't know he's mad because they're using her maiden name yet? That's hilarious.
Yeah,
that scene with those three girls. They are so funny, so cute.
And
he's
one of them, when they're singing, when they're singing in the highways, one of them is actively trying not to look at the camera, and it's hilarious. She's moving her head every which way, but to not look at the camera.
And I think they're actually like totally fine with one of them being like a little underpitched the whole time in that song, which makes it like adorable. I bet you they all could have nailed it. And they're like, let's have one of you just be a little under. And it works really well.
Well, then
it
my
sounds
question
pretty realistic.
Is it actually them singing? Because, I mean, there's a few other. I feel like this movie is a mix of like they hired the talent to then play the part that they're singing, but then also like George Clooney is not singing and neither is John Turturro. So who it's a bit of a mixed bag. And honestly, I don't give a shit. It's a great
Tim Blake sounds fucking great. But yeah, I actually like how George Clooney's voice, they didn't even try to do like the Disney thing where they kind of sound alike. George didn't sound anything like him. And it actually makes it funnier. I don't know. It makes it
how much
better.
Do you think? How much do you think they coached him or he coached himself to try to move his head with the riffs? Because that helped.
Oh, yeah.
Believe the lip syncing. You know what I'm talking about? Like whenever there's a scoop or a tiny little riff, he would give you like a little, which, you know, I think people can watch a music video and think like, okay, it's helpful when artists do that. It kind of makes it look real. And
they
maybe he was singing along and doing it, but it definitely helped, especially when he's recording the first time into the can. which is very helpful for them. You could hide his lip syncing if it wasn't perfect, but he still had the, you know, he would still give you the little jolts of head movement, which were super authentic. I think it helped a lot.
I honestly had that thought too about him recording it because they're hiding his mouth, but like, no, he is full, like, he is committed. It looks like he is actually lip syncing and he is doing like the movements. Yeah. He's got the veins coming out of his neck.
Arteries coming. Yeah. It's pumping, dude. Yeah. You can see it. I think he was singing.
He's got
along.
The Bernadettes.
Bernadettes. I didn't know that's what y'all called it. That's good.
No,
I
don't.
I don't call it that.
I just made it up.
It is for now on. That is exactly what it is. But oh yeah, man.
And she has two Tonys.
She has two Tonys. But yes, John, I agree with what you're saying about his backstory. The gift of gab, as he refers to his ability to just talk and spin a yarn and blah, blah, blah. He very easily could have been from somewhere else.
Anywhere. So, he could be a traveling salesman, like, or something. You never know.
Yeah. Maybe he's selling Dapper Dan and he's not just masturbating with it.
So many cans of Dapper Dan at the end in the flood. Just like, oh my God, we get it. You're very vain and you love your hair. I guess with he's that, masturbating look, as well.
If that, I don't know how you did it land for you guys, but they always have elements of surrealism in their movies. And the way it kind of finds its way in is always fun. The flood and the imagery was just bullseye Coen Brothers. All the Dapper Dans totally worked for me. The cow floating underneath in the, or the dog, it was the bloodhound that floats by underwater. And just all these, I don't know, I just thought it was absolutely perfect. Like, because the music heightens the reality of their scenario. The comedy heightens the reality of their journey up until that point. But nothing is totally surreal yet until the flood comes and until they have that giant sequence underwater.
Right.
Would you agree with that? Or do you think there are elements of like true surrealism? Because well, I think that's the first...
Because you can say that the guy that they meet in the beginning who gives them the premonition, he could just be crazy, you know?
Yeah.
He could be whatever. The women, the sirens, they're not actually doing what sirens do when they sing their song. I think they are using their feminine wiles, so to speak, to lure the men into their trap, and then like Pete then later admits that they tied him up and sold him for the bounty. Which is
sorry,
so,
I gotta take
so
care
dumb.
Of mine.
Oh god, all they
know we're kin and all.
They only left this heart.
I think maybe the only other magical realism moment would be when John Goodman catches the flag mere inches away from his face. Like but that's like cinema magic, you know? That's not
I agree.
I agree with you that the fact that they survived the flood at the end, because God only knows what happened to the other people who were there, but like the four of them who survived, it's just wild. And then the ending, the button being that what's her name, Penny,
Holly Hunter.
Yeah, Penny.
Yeah, that's not my ring. That's my aunt's ring. Counting to three. She's counting to three. Like
I said, it might be in the round drawer. What
the
is
rolling
that
desk.
Rolling top drawer.
Yeah, or it might be under the bed, or in my nightgown, or in the. And you're like, Jesus Christ! And the fact that she is making him go back to the lake and find the ring, I'm like, just get a new one at this point. But again, it doesn't matter, because I think what I like about Coen Brothers films is that whatever happens before or after this story is not important. You're watching what they want you to watch. Like,
that's true.
They did A Simple Man, right?
Yeah.
The one that's basically the Book of Job. Yes. So, like that one is another one where you're just focused on that. Who cares what happened before? Who cares if they survive the hurricane or whatever at the end of a Simple Man? So for this one, like, they're
a
walking
serious
off
man?
Screen.
Is they that... did A Serious Man.
A Serious Man.
Is that
that's
what you're
it.
Talking about? Yeah,
yes.
yeah, yeah.
Again, that one's based off of the Book of Job, which I doubt they read all of it. So,
yeah, no way.
Or if they did, they were high and laughing and be like, oh, fuck.
And it's always fun to do, which, you know, we've seen it before, but I think it's always so effective in period films when you hand off the period to a more contemporary setting by the end of it. So this movie isn't entirely about the South changing, but it resolves that way. It kind of ends on that note, that the flood kind of represents these old ways are going to kind of only be told through song, through stories, because we're going to be on a grid. We're going to be electrified. You know, the whole speech he's giving. And then that final image with the pushcart man, again, kind of cutting through the middle of this town. And there's some modern looking stuff around.
It's a hand car.
Oh, that's what it's called.
So I think part of them is also, I think they're definitely, again, maybe this is a little bit more highbrow thematic kind of shit with filmmaking, but I think they're using this based on the story of like the Odyssey, and they're telling a tale that feels period and it feels like it must have been a very long time ago. And it ends in a place that reminds you this was not that long ago. Like really, your grandparents and great grandparents were alive. This isn't hundreds of years ago, you know?
Right. At the time of the release, it was 70 years ago. And now we're getting close to it being set almost 100 years ago, which is still fairly recent. And you mentioned that, you know, the advances in technology, but also the social advances of the fact that they had Tommy Johnson, a man of color, in an all-white room playing guitar and nobody said anything about it except for that one candidate, but they all don't care what he says. You know, they don't boo Tommy off the stage. They don't, they don't throw rotten food at him. They throw it at Homer Stokes. Yeah.
Progressing. Yeah. I mean,
everything got better after that 1930s.
Everything got better.
Did it?
I guess so. We did still pass. You know, and I guess they were going for accurate and authenticity here. Most of the people in those chain gangs were black men.
Yeah.
You know, so it was nice that they were at least not trying to make it look like, oh, this is a world where, you know, it's all white people.
There's
cool hand Luke has like no black people. You remember, like every now and then you'll see those movies where you're just like, really? I don't know if I believe that.
Yeah. But, there's one song in this movie that, okay, don't judge me, but feel free to judge me. Every time I see this movie, whenever they sing down to the river to pray, I just start bawling. I don't know why. I don't understand it. And it's usually around the time that Tim Blake Nelson has his whole monologue about being saved. And like when he says, come on in, boys, the water's fine. Like, I'm done. I don't know why though. Like, I'm not a religious person by any means. I guess this is a testament to the Coen brothers and who was the cinematographer for this?
Roger Deakins.
Yeah. Like, him playing with the white of the costumes and they have like that sepia tone throughout the whole movie, and it's just beautiful art. And I don't know, I was just like I need to mention this because it's every time, and I even mentally prepare myself being like, that scene's going to happen, and then inevitably I just start crying.
This movie was shot so well for Roger Deakins. I mean, he's really one of the best ever, but he did Fargo. He did a lot of their movies all the way up through A Serious Man, I think, if he didn't go past them. And God damn it, this movie looks so good. From the hand car where they pan up, like as they're going off into the abyss and you see, you know, the vista and everything. There's so many shots like that are just the opening when you see the chain gang and they have the song, and then you see them from far away in the field, and then the three guys pop up in the field, which I think is the poster. Right? It's so good. How do they get that framing? How do they get that lighting? How do they get that focus? It's so good. It's stunning. It's stunning.
So one of the interesting things, just since we're talking about that, this was not the first film that they shot digitally. They still shot this on film, but this is the first film that was totally color graded digitally.
Oh.
So that's, and that's, it's a unique thing because everyone who can think of this movie immediately thinks of how yellow it is and how there's a very, such clear color to the way they did this. And it was the very first time that they had not used traditional celluloid timing with chemicals and the way we did it for so long. First time they had ever done a digital interface and a digital intermediate. A DIT was introduced into the process. They were kind of making it up as they went because they knew what they wanted it to look like. But unlike, you know, a lot of things that they think of nowadays, let me put it this way. There are some very long transitional dissolves where you can see in the middle of the dissolve, the world is still green until it becomes yellow. Like you can actually like see it move in and out of some things because, and I'm sure they left that. I'm sure it was intended, but I think they wanted it to have this very affected, stylized kind of feel. It was almost like you could just smell hay everywhere you went. And like the tree, you know, there was such an unnatural aspect of the way it looks visually.
Now you're saying that this is the first time for the Coen brothers, but not the first time ever, correct?
Ever.
Oh, it's the first time ever.
Yeah. Holy shit. A movie of this scale, which all that really means is when you see that in like trivia, there may have been other smaller projects that had dabbled with it. This was the first time a major motion picture with heavy hitters that the world saw was totally digitally colored. It was still shot on film though.
Wow. This did not win best cinematography at the Oscars. Obviously Roger Deakins famously didn't win for like his first 15 nominations or whatever, but look what it is up against this year. You have Gladiator. You have The Patriot. You have Milena. You also have Traffic, which was not nominated. You
That's crazy.
Quills was not nominated. The Perfect Storm was not nominated. And then the winner, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. What a year of stunning movies.
Oh, Crouching Tiger.
What a fucking year.
That dominated that year. Like,
that movie's great.
Yeah, I think a lot of people thought that it should have won director picture, which would go to Gladiator. But no, director actually went to Traffic for Steven Soderbergh. Sorry.
And didn't Crouching Tiger win Best Picture?
No, Gladiator won Best Picture.
Traffic won Best Picture. Oh, Gladiator won Best Picture.
Traffic won Best Director.
Soderbergh won Best Director.
Wow.
Yeah. But anyway, it way back to what you just said about how moving the baptism sequence is. Isn't that, can't you imagine if you're using music as a tool, of course, but as filmmakers, you have your characters and clearly one of them needs to feel strong enough to be swept up by what you were describing to actually go get baptized, right? These three criminals, it's not an intellectual decision he makes to try to go get saved. It's purely emotional.
Yeah. And he's the idiot of the group.
And he's the dumbass, which again, might be a little commentary from the Coen brothers.
Well, it's interesting because like there's that moment earlier in the film where they're leaving a gas station or a side road. I don't know what exactly it was, but they steal someone's car. However,
even though they had money.
However, Everett and Pete, George Clooney and John Turturro, both had like the same idea, but then John Turturro had to like pull Tim Blake Nelson in. So it's kind of like, although George Clooney and John Turturro throughout the whole movie are having this power struggle, like they're all in it together. And it could have been easily that the George Clooney character was the lazy bum who like was the quote unquote mastermind, but it's all dumb luck. And he doesn't lift a finger in any which way. But I appreciated that in this movie that the three of them are all, you know, doing the things, you know, it's not just that he's the leader and the other two are doing everything. No, they're all like planning and they're all figuring stuff out. And in one of the several montages in this movie, it feels like, you know, they're actually getting along and hanging out and, you know, being friends. Granted, it makes me question how long time is in this because they mention how from their escape to when they need to get get to the treasure, if you will. It's like 4 days, but some of those montages felt like it was like a week already. So
I mean, I think it was like around a month, because isn't there some comment or information about how well their song is doing?
Well, that's
it's like been on the top
thing,
of
though.
The...
They keep talking about how they need to get there in like 4 days, record the song, and then unless the dam blows up, and what doesn't affect the house that George Clooney's house, which by the way is the house from Evil Dead, that is the same exact.
Oh, weird!
Oh my god!
Because one of the Coen brothers worked on that. He was one of the editors, or like a
what?
Joel
editor.
Yeah, yeah. So they went to NYU together.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Obviously redressed to make it look Southern and everything, and not creepy like in the Evil Dead movies. But yeah, God, this movie's great.
I think the movie's fun. It's like loopy, and it's just fun. It's fun. I know that Fargo, Blood Simple, like, you know, No Country, are they're classics, you know, that are gonna be like the, you know, like the critical movies. But this movie's just a fucking great rewatchable movie.
I think I know. Can't quote every single or say everybody's name that would say this, but in my life, I think I have met multiple people who say this is their favorite Coen Brothers movie. Like they like verbatim, but this is the one that stands out.
Mine is Fargo, but I wish it was this one. This is probably number two.
Okay, and you're a Lebowski up there on your list.
Yeah, it's number two. John's a Lebowski fan. I love Lebowski too, but it's not my top two.
How funny is Lebowski as the incumbent governor in this?
With such a big fupa. How big is his
God
fupa when he's sitting on that
so
porch?
So funny, well, that, dude. Every one of those scenes is hilarious.
I mean, I appreciate the costumes for this, because I'm like, that's where it would be. You would wear it at your natural waist, not like we currently wear pants. And you would have the suspenders, and they would have some sleeves rolled up, because everyone wore long sleeves back then, even in the South when it's... I'm assuming this is summertime. I mean,
it looks hot as fuck, but it is Mississippi.
Sweaty everywhere all the time. I mean, yeah.
But is there anything else y'all want to talk about before we get into Sharp and Flat?
Just that the aha moment when George Clooney confesses that there's no treasure. I feel like one of those movies that could not sink the movie, but it could be a dud. But I got to give it up to the reactions of John Turturro and Tim Blake Nelson, the way they're underplaying it, and they're just like this surprise that lingers for like a minute before John Turturro starts getting really angry with him. I just think that's really well done.
After they save John Turturro from getting rearrested, and then like the fact that they get pardoned, but then
they don't have a radio. That guy, I guess he's supposed to be Poseidon and or the devil, right? That the detective guy.
Yes. Yeah. Daniel Von Bargen, I feel like I've seen him before. I feel like he plays villains.
Look at him.
Yeah. Oh, he's Chief Grady in Super Troopers. That's how I know.
Oh my God.
Literally. Okay, okay. He played the sheriff in this one. A year later, Super Troopers comes out, and he's the villain or the antagonist of that one as well. Like,
that's God.
No wonder I'm like, you must play a villain. Look at you.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
All right, let's get into Sharp and Flat, shall we?
Yeah!
Sharp Flat.
So in this section, we're going to highlight some moments, whether or not we talked about it. If we liked it, it's sharp. And if we didn't like it or thought it could change, it's flat. I'm not going to lie, guys. I didn't have any flats. I tried. I watched this movie critically, and I was just like, everything you're doing is historical, and yes, there's some language used, but it's historical or lightly historical, because the fact that they didn't actually full-blown say the N-word, I'm like, good for you guys for not doing that. Don't be Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah. No, I would agree. Not to make your section boring.
I don't think so.
Boring,
I'm trying to think, and
it's very rare this happens. But like, honestly, I everything felt great. I mean, I guess I could ding them for dubbing George Clooney, but who knows what he sounds like when he sings. They probably wanted a specific sound rather than what George Clooney can do. I got nothing.
I think it's honestly pretty funny. I'll just say fucking George Nelson for shooting the livestock. You dick. You made me angry.
Well, that's CGI.
No, George, not the livestock.
That's all CGI. And they actually had the Humane Society. Like the Humane Society forced them to show the CGI, like how it's done and everything. Cause it looks so realistic. Granted, watch it now. And when he shoots the cow, you're like, this is fake. And then when the other cow gets run over by the car, like that's so fake. But I guess in 1999,
it looked great. I thought that car getting hit by a cow getting hit by the car looked fantastic.
Yeah.
But also the answer to that, if that's like the terrible question of like, oh no, he shot the cow. When they're finally marching them down to get electrocuted, you know, there's a cow with them.
The cow gets his revenge too.
Cow killer.
Yeah. I mean, they get theirs. I think my only potential flat is the accent thing. Like maybe they could have just justified it with a single tiny little line breadcrumb of he's not from here. And I would have been complete. It's something I think about every time I watch this movie. And it's also just because I think George Clooney was on the rise when this movie came out. You know, he was really turning into massive star George Clooney. And I think people were starting to be aware of the fact that he kind of plays George Clooney in everything. And so it's just, I kind of can't, which isn't necessarily a problem. That's a lot of times movie stars play themselves and that's why they're fucking movie stars. But there's no justification for it in this movie. It's not in the script and it bumps me just a little bit every time. He's funny. It doesn't ultimately destroy the movie at all for me, but it's might be the only thing that isn't fucking pitch perfect.
Okay. No, yeah. I guess I just wrote my own backstory for it. It's like, because he comes off as such a liar throughout the whole movie that like anything he tells us, we don't know if it's going to be true or not. So even if they justify it with a line, is it true?
Yeah. No, you're right.
To play devil's advocate for a hot second. But yes, I will agree with you. Like,
sure that's what. What you just said, I'm sure, is what they are hoping everybody thinks when they watch this movie. Like, there are plenty of reasons why he wouldn't have an accent, and we'll let the audience decide.
Figure it out. Jeff, did you actually have a flat, or do you?
No, I didn't. Except I was just kidding about the livestock killing because I thought it was great.
Really. All right, sharps. I sharped the historical elements because, like, it seems just enough that it's not like we're giving you a history lesson on it. It's like, these are real people, but we're fucking around and we're changing things up and details up. So that's why I sharped that. I also sharped Everett and Vernon's fight in the general store. Cause it was just,
oh yeah,
so silly.
I'm looking at it right now.
The way that they're both just, their arms are just like, they're like flexing and showing off their biceps and everything. I'm also sharpening. This is going to sound bad, but it's hilarious. John Goodman's mask only having one eye hole in it.
Oh, just it's
one
so
giant
good.
Hole.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
So fun. And then he lifts up the mask and you see that he's blind in one eye. Like,
oh,
it's
yeah.
Just,
we got to see the eye.
It was so
really
funny.
Great.
And then I mentioned this earlier, but I'm going to stripe the fact that they had the restraint not to use the N-word. Like, they used the other N-word.
I think Stephen Root said it once, but I don't know.
Or if they, I mean, they
maybe
said it
Prime
once.
Prime got
then.
Rid of it, but I'm pretty sure Stephen Root said it. But his character, I should say, his character, not like Stephen Root
right,
says
of course.
It.
But like, you know that if Quentin Tarantino were to write the script, every other word would be that word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For
the lawmen that are like working the change gangs would have way bigger lines. They'd have way more characters.
Yes, and of course this would be uber violent if it was
so many deaths.
Quentin Tarantino in this. John, did you what about you? What were your sharps for this?
As usual with them, I mean, I'm just going to in general sharp the comedy, like that line they have of their dark sense of humor the way it's all played very sincerely, that, you know, it almost gets into that place of like satire, but it doesn't, there's enough love for the subject matter and for the place that you don't feel like they're just making fun of it. They, yeah, they really are like doing, you know, impersonation is the greatest, you know, kind of compliment or whatever. So this movie is just laugh out loud funny pretty much in every scene. There's a moment where you're going to laugh without it line? Just being jokes. It's not jokes, you know, it's all situational.
Yeah,
my favorite line but today, I've just, you know, watching it last night, I keep saying, but we're in a tight spot, I keep just saying that to myself. Just anyway, some of their funny dialogue stuff.
Mine is when Pete's cousin and his son, that little boy with the gun, is shooting at them. And then he's like, oh, we don't like lawmen. We're not lawmen. Nobody's going to serve papers. We don't have papers. And he's like, I'll shoot you. I nicked a census, man. And Tim Blake Nelson goes, now there's a good boy.
Where, is your daddy about, son? Guys, I'm telling you, like, I grew up, I mean, they still, people still talk like that. I mean, I just like, all the funny phrases that I bet y'all just thought were like, oh, like nobody mm-hmm. talks like that anymore. That's just like, so that people still talk like that.
He's my kin.
He's my kin. You stole from my kin.
I know we's kin and all, but it's.
I think one of my, I really laughed very hard this time at the dancing at the end.
Like
on stage. George was funny. The boys are funny. But when Pappy comes on stage.
Oh, yeah.
And he like does this little jig thing towards them.
Oh, he's so good. I mean,
that shit was really, really, really funny.
To keep on the accent talk, it's interesting that Pappy does like a weird Irish Southern accent. Because there's moments where I'm like, that sounds more Irish than Southern. And there's other moments where I'm like, oh, now we're in Mississippi land with your voice. So I'm not sure if that actor is Irish, in fact.
Charles Durning. He's so good. He would be whatever accent he needed to be. I don't think his own accent would get in unless it was a choice. Right. He also fought in World War II.
Yeah, I'm reading that now.
I liked, again,
he's from Highland Falls, New York. You know what? Adding a shot to Charles Durning and that hybrid accent that he did, because I guess they're also making more commentary on like immigration or something, and the fact that like some Irish people may have found their way down south and affected his accent in a way. I don't know. I'm just spitballing here. John, do you have any other sharps?
In light of the, this is such a tiny detail, but I thought it was fun. And I could totally see them on set being like, we'll just try it this time and we'll see if it makes it in. This is the rise of the George Clooney machine. I think everybody thought he was kind of a sex symbol. It's funny that they put someone who looks like that with this group of idiots, you know, but like you said, he's not the ultimate genius. Like trying to play with that, that's another General Store moment. When he's talking to Holly Hunter and she's in a close-up and she is like almost leans in and kisses him because she's trying to like keep her, you know, I'm not going to marry you. I'm not going to go with him. But he gets in her face and is talking to her and she like melts and like almost just like leans in and starts making out with him because he's just so beautiful. And I just thought that was a funny little moment that was commenting on, we do know who we cast. We do know that most people would encounter this man and be like, what are you doing here? You know?
Yeah, because prior to this, he was really only known as for General Hospital, right?
ER. Sorry, but I think he's in a movie too, because the Batman movie had already come out by this point.
Oh,
Batman
that's right,
come out, and the vampire movie, Tarantino, the one he wrote that Rodriguez directed.
Oh, From Dusk Till Dawn.
Yeah, hadn't that already come out too?
Yes, it did. It was From Dusk Till Dawn, and then Batman and Robin. And then The Thin Red Line, and then South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut, just because it's hilarious to mention that.
Yeah.
And then it was Oh Brother, followed by Perfect Storm, and then Spy Kids, Ocean's 11. So,
yeah, off and running.
Yeah.
And the final sharp will just be the filmmaking. It's just because we're all struggling to find a flat. And I think part of that, it goes back to is it 100 hour and 26 or was it hour 47? I couldn't tell you because the pace is, it's perfect.
So
it's near perfectly paced. And the coverage is non-existent. Every shot feels like it's the only shot that they grabbed. You know, it doesn't ever feel like they just, and that could be said for a lot of their movies, but this one was just, I don't know. It's just the humor and the filmmaking. It was just, it feels like a real bullseye for them. Most of their things are very successful commercially, but I think this one was like, I don't know. They did something. This got under the skin, I feel like, of the American public, and it still holds up artistically. I don't think it was just catchy because the songs were great.
It's got a meta score of 69. So we're doing great.
That
everyone.
Dropped. Fuck that.
Yeah, it probably has come down over the years. Who knows?
Just wanted to mention because it's a funny number.
I saw the Ebert score was he gave 2.5 stars because he said it was great, but probably not as good as their other ones because it left him wanting a little more. And it's like, yeah, you gotta define that for me. I don't know. I need more. I'm gonna sharp Roger Deakins, and I want to add one more shot, which is when you can see the rail, you can see the station, the radio station as the car is coming up and the dust is flying off it. There's a lot of car dust shots in movies, but that one is so especially good with the yellows, with the gray of that going up, and then just that one radio station with the tower to send the signal out.
Are you talking about when those people are on the back singing and playing with the broom?
No. But that's hilarious. I think this is when the guys that they're running in to try to catch the I actually can't remember because it's not the first time. I don't think it's the first time they pull up, but it might be the first time they pull up to the radio station.
Or is it when they're leaving and Pappy comes to the radio station that you're talking about?
I'm gonna based on when I wrote it in my little notes here, I'm gonna say it's when Pappy shows up.
Okay. Nice. Well, yeah, Pappy the cinematography is pretty stunning. So that, pretty perfect.
What else is it gonna sharp? Oh, Stephen Root's performance as the blind radio show. Like unbelievable. Stephen Root's great, and I only knew him as Milton from Office Space the first time I saw this movie.
Yes.
So I didn't know him from his like comedy background days, and I just saw a video of him recently. Obviously Dodgeball and, you know, Barry and some other shows. But so I thought Stephen Root was great. And I feel like we covered everything else that I would have said. But also Tim Blake Nelson's so funny. It's really, he's a really strange kind of like not your average person, but God, he's so fun in this movie. He's so funny.
Are the Coen brothers not working together anymore? Or are they just...
They do this thing where one directs and the other writes, and they kind of like take some turns now.
Yeah,
right?
But I'm looking at their more recent stuff, and like it looks like they're branching... Like The Ballad of Buster Scruggs was the last time they worked together. Obviously, they're still attached to Fargo, the TV show.
They're still brothers. Oh, yeah.
Right, but I wasn't sure if either of you heard something about like they had a fallout and they're doing their own thing, or they're just doing their own things.
I mean, Joel will do his own thing every now and I think this past time when Joel decided to do the tragedy of Macbeth, I think Ethan decided to make his own movie too.
Yeah,
so
which he did.
There was more
dolls.
Time. Yeah, so the more time passed before I think they would, because he was making his project.
Right.
But I haven't heard. I'm.
Oh, better not, because
but I am
fuck,
friends
they're...
with a. One of the guys who does their re-recording sound, he works with Skip Leafsey, who has done all of their he does all the final mixes. I know the guy who does the sound effects with Skip. Skip does dialogue and music, and he does sound effects and backgrounds. So he's worked with them for the past like 15 years or so, and they're still friends of the very well. They get along, and I'm sure they're going to do more projects together. I haven't heard anything weird about them happening. Sorry?
Was this at the shop?
That's where I met him, yeah. Yeah. So they're still doing it. But yeah, I don't know why Ethan was not involved with the tragedy of Macbeth, which is where they initially kind of took a break and Joel went and made that. Who knows? I could totally see Ethan being like, who fucking cares? You know, I don't want to do Shakespeare, dude. I say this every time I like to just share this anecdote because I just thought it was so Coen Brothers. I saw them down at the Metrograph Theater when they were premiering Buster Scruggs, and I went to it, and they were doing a Q&A afterwards. And somebody asked them about how they felt. The person in the audience wasn't like wagging their finger, but they were asking them, has it been annoying that you've had to always navigate the way y'all use violence? And there's always some critic or somebody who seems to think that y'all just make violent movies. And Ethan goes very quietly. He goes, well, people are horrible to each other, and that's what makes life interesting. And it's like, I just thought that was just so perfect. Yeah. So even in a movie like this, how hard were you laughing the second time they saw the barn being lit on fire?
Oh,
where
my
men
God.
Were trying to light them ablaze, like burn them alive. And you're just like, somehow we're laughing about it.
I mean, I was also laughing the first time when the guns in the police car.
Oh, so good.
Oh, my
like,
God.
We're going off.
And John he keeps so yelling funny. At them while they would shoot at him, and then he runs out and like starts yelling at them. They shoot back at him.
So funny. So funny.
Would you add any of the songs to your life's playlist? I listened to this album.
All of it.
I have listened to this album. I will listen to this album regularly. So
yeah. I think I will now. I don't think I'm not gonna lie, I haven't really said it yet, but I didn't respond to my first watch the way I did to this rewatch. I think the first time I watched it, I was like, eh.
When was the first time you watched it? Out of curiosity.
I think it was what Jeff referred to at the very beginning of this, where I think me and him and our other roommate at the time watched it together.
What year is this?
In New York, probably 10 years-ish ago. Because I did not see it when it came out. I think I dodged it. So anyway, I had a great, great rewatch, and I could totally see why. I'm sure I will play some music from this in the future for my own personal listening enjoyment.
Yeah, I think it's great.
Yeah, Alison Krauss is one of the singers who you hear her voice in the movie, but like she's more prominent on the soundtrack because like they focus more on the performers and not like the world building performances. Like in Down to the River to Pray, it's mostly her voice, but you do hear like a chorus behind her. Singing.
Oh, okay, cool.
So it sounds slightly different, but it's still the same. So
yeah, I want her and Robert Plant to do the sequel.
The sister,
Robert Plant. Yeah,
are they together?
He'll be the second verse.
Oh, okay, got it. well, guys, on that note, we are done with the episode. We did it.
Oh my God!
And Jeff didn't bring up semen again. So
I brought up semen in our live show very early in the show.
Yeah, he did. When we did,
I really thought there was semen reference in
that was a cotton ball that he sang and that he ate in Across the Universe. Not a ball.
I really
semen.
Thought.
And I will not let you. I will not let that down.
I was on stage, and people were like, "Did you watch the movie?" And I like, I was like, I felt like all the lights and cameras turned on me. And I was like, yes."
And you started talking about semen.
Yeah, right before.
Yeah,
have you seen Across the Universe?
And my parents were watching.
Yeah.
So right before I Want You, when he goes into to the draft center, and he takes the cotton ball that is supposed to show up on the X-ray on his lung. Jeff thought that was semen.
I thought they were trying to put semen in him so he would be a homosexual and he wouldn't be allowed in the army. I don't know.
No, as long as he doesn't have flat feet.
Or shin splints.
Anyway, Jeff and John, what do you have to plug or promote?
John just did plug a good episode of 21 Grams that came out today with Dave, and I wasn't there. Not my fault, you.
Yeah, we'll just do our show, Love Cinema. We just talked about 21 Grams this past week.
Well, of this recording, this is going to come out.
Oh, I see.
In like a month.
Okay,
so.
Well then, we'll just in general, the love of cinema, listening to us every week. We have a random year generator. We pick a new movie based on that random year generator, and we tell you about that year, the movies that came out, and we also talk about going to a deep dive of one movie in particular. So
we've watched a lot of good movies.
Oh, yeah.
But you also have the game that we didn't... I mean, none of us dinged anybody or anything. This
I don't know
episode,
how to not
kind of.
Drink you while doing would've. A podcast, yeah, though. Same. So Jeff and I were just drinking anyway while we were doing this.
Yeah.
Right. But you on it your podcast, like you have a whole sound.
We are playing a drinking game. Yes. Well, when you listen to us, you will hear us and we explain it from the top. If we say anything negative or stupid or lazy, we buzz each other. So you inevitably end up buzzing each other because we end up drinking more and then saying more of those things. But
oh no, you guys want to drink more? Damn.
Dave just like tries to drink as much as possible during our episodes.
Well, he's Australian, so whatever.
Yeah.
Well, John, thank you so much for having us on. I yes, did not make you. Scheduling easy, but you're yes, a persistent no, and I very I'm, much appreciate it.
I'm so happy we were able, well, it, getting four people schedules together to
That's
do
what
a
we should have just
recording.
Not even tried, to be honest with you.
Yeah. But if you, I don't know, if you, the listener, wants to talk more about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, or have questions as to why we didn't do it earlier as advertised, well, we just answered it. you can email me at buttersongpod@gmail.com. Also on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and Threads at buttersongpod. Did you also grow up listening to these songs, like John said that he did? I mean,
some of them. I went to church.
Most of them, so, yeah.
Yeah.
And if you want to be part of the next episode's conversation, well, we will be discussing The Happiest Millionaire.
Aww.
Well, guys, thank you so much for coming back on. Maybe next time you pick one. Because,
yeah.
All right.
I mean, I picked the two that we did already, and they were pretty great episodes.
They're great.
So,
if you've manied for anybody, let us know and we'll do their movie.
I have not manied for anybody, unfortunately. So, but thank you everyone for listening, and bye for now.
Peace. Bye.
Special thanks to Aaron Troy for creating the pod's artwork and to Nick Bombacino for composing the theme song and the jingles. A huge thank you to CastBox for hosting this podcast. And thank you again for tuning in to today's episode of Life's But a Song. Bye for now, everyone, and have a musical day.